This program is sponsored by Dave Stahl.
Start your engine.
Race fans, you are tuning into the only motorsports show in San Diego. Your host, Dave Stahl, and the racing school teacher, Brittany Sandoval, are taking you to the green flag, covering everything from your top-notch national drivers and crew chiefs right down to your local kid racers and racetracks. Strap in, it's Checkers and Wreckers on Racer Radio.
All right, folks. Hey, welcome to Racer Radio FM 96.1 AM 1170.
The answer.
What do you mean you weren't going to tell me?
I wanted to keep everything pure in your head and unbiased.
Now it's dirty.
And now it's dirty.
Southwest Point of Sale. If you got a business with a cashier and you're having trouble getting cashiers, well, Southwest Point of Sale can hook you up. Call 800-540-2149. Or go to southwestpos.com. Labor costs are skyrocketing. Do like Walmart, Home Depot, and Costco, dude. Go self-checkout. All you got to do is call them, 800-540-2149. Mark or Jeff will come out, take a look at your facility. If it works, you're ahead of the game. 7 day a week, 24-hour day service. And it won't cost you any more than you'd pay for a cash register. So if you're open, they're open. Also, San Diego Gear and Axle. Hey, I'm telling you what, man, anything in the undercarriage, Steve is the guy. Specializes in drag racing, but he could do off-road, circle track. If it's got a drivetrain, he's got the answer. Go to sdgearaxle.com. And last but not least, Dragonfly Auto Care Repair. These guys are amazing over on Pacific Coast Highway. They're Napa Auto Care, the ASC certified, AAA approved. Check these guys out. That's Dragonfly. All right, we got a special guest in the house.
Yes.
Brittany.
Oh, I'm the special guest?
Sure.
Oh. And off air, we'll clarify what you just brought up.
Thank you very
much. I don't like to perpetuate rumors.
I appreciate it. Yeah. I don't either.
But anyway.
So who's this old
guy? Oh, man, we have a motorcycle industry icon sitting
in
the studio.
And I knew who he was.
Oh, good, good. Well, let's make sure the listeners know. He was recently recognized by Legends and Heroes this January at the San Diego Supercross, so right. Congratulations on that. Yeah. He worked for decades behind the scenes for Honda, mm-hmm. whether it was mechanic, research and development, team manager. He's looking at you. Oh, yeah. We'll get to that, too. Chronologically, it makes sense why he is now wearing a Triumph.
Well, I'm a Honda guy. I've always been a Honda
decades,
guy.
Decades for Honda. So you'll like that. And he worked with the likes of Roger DeCoster, Marty Smith, David Bailey. Next week, we're going to have Donnie Hansen on. He worked with Donnie Hansen, Jeremy McGrath, Rick Johnson, just to name a few. Wow. So please welcome AMA Hall of Fame inductee as well, Dave Arnold. Welcome.
Pull that mic over there so you can yell at it. How you doing, Dave?
Very good, and thanks for having me, Dave and Brittany.
Yes. Thanks for coming all the way down. He had quite a drive.
Where'd you come from?
Down the five.
Oh. Yeah, north of L.A. area. Yeah. San Fernando Valley, right? Up in the hills.
Ooh.
I know. He came all the way down.
You didn't bring the helicopter?
No, no.
Honda's got one.
No. Yeah, he probably does.
Got a jet, too. So, you came down for the... the event last night,
Trailblazers. I went to the Trailblazer thing last night, mainly because they were inducting a couple of motocross guys. It's primarily a dirt track event, but they're transitioning and, having some of the motocrossers. Lackey got inducted, I believe, last year. And this year was DeCoster and Brock Glover. He's a local senior.
Yeah, for sure.
So they inducted him last night?
Yeah.
That's cool. And Don MD's in charge of that, right?
Yes, he is.
He was just sitting in that seat 2 weeks ago.
No, he's a good guy.
And boy, did he send me a box of books.
My gosh, he sent me a picture. So, Don, you made Dave very happy.
Because I like to read. You know, I like to read what I want to read.
Yeah.
So Don was sitting there. He goes, well, I got a few books I can send you.
Yeah. I don't know all encompassing what, but I had to do a magazine for a museum event back in Chicago. And boy, he knew all about editing and how to put it together.
Yeah, he's a publisher and writer. And but let's focus on you. You made the trip down here. I don't know, Mr. Honda lover here. I have lots of questions, but let's start with you.
No, you go ahead, ladies first.
No. Go ahead.
No, I mean, when, now, did you ride? Did you ever ride, or are you working on the back end?
No. I rode way before I went to work for American Honda. Not professionally, but I think everybody, all my demographic friends up in the San Fernando Valley in the foothills, we rode dirt bikes. And yeah. I think a lot of the kids after the Vietnam War, if they call those the baby boomers, I'm not sure. But
I've been there,
for some reason, we got into street bikes and dirt bikes, and that became a lifetime passion.
Yeah.
Well, I am a Honda fanatic. Yep. I mean, everything I buy, I have a Honda generator. I bought a Honda Monkey.
He had a Honda Monkey.
I had a Honda Monkey. She took a picture of me on it. I look like a circus bear. So she now owns it with 11 miles on it. And to use to go up to the racetracks, because I'm too old to be huffing around, I bought a Honda Talon.
Yeah.
1000X. So I love Hondas. Yes. And I had a 74 Honda Civic. It was autocross, had fender flares, 13 inches of rubber on the ground, roll cage, the whole bit. Yeah.
Is it safe to say, Dave, that you love Hondas? I mean, having been...
No, so Cheryl Honda, the founder, was alive and loved racing and would go to many of the race events that we, you know, I mean, mostly if we race in Japan toward the end of the year, whether it would be at Suzuka Circuit or like a Tokyo Supercross or
something.
So you
raced
like
all the big ones, huh?
Yeah, worldwide. I would say in the 70s, but in the 80s when things started to roll.
How old were you when you started?
Yeah.
No, I think I was around 19, 18, 19.
Well, did you have family that raced before you?
No. I was sort of an outcast. I mean, I had brothers and sisters that, I would say mainly brothers, that liked to ride dirt bikes.
But they weren't.
But no, I mean, it really wasn't anything that the family, which I think was a bit... That was a bit common that, I mean, a lot of the, if you go back into the 60s, kids weren't getting along very well with the parents. But into the 70s, I think that one thing that really helped motocross is it was viewed, you look at a Roger DeCosta or a Marty Smith, it was pretty clean cut. They had to be somewhat athletic. The sport seemed, it was something.
And the family supported them heavy duty.
It was a family supported. We could buy a dirt bike for $600-$700 and... So I think that really did help start some of the popularity of motocross.
So when you came home and told mom and dad, I'm going to be gone for a while.
Well, it started even before then when it came. It was a family that everybody had to go to college after you got finished with high school.
Okay.
And my dad was a bona fide engineer. He worked for Lockheed and formerly educated at Iowa State. And we all had to sign up for something like that. And academically, I wasn't really that guy coming through high school. And so then I saw they had motorcycle technical courses at Trade Tech. It was a trade school. And so I
okayed that
reluctantly, I think. But I mean, they embraced that. They thought that was a good fit. And then I did well at that. And then the teacher helped get a couple of the top students placed. And a friend of mine, Mark Porter, went to Yamaha, and I ended up at Honda shortly after.
Oh, wow. I mean, you applied yourself. Oh, my gosh. You applied
yourself.
Well,
if you want to do what you enjoy doing, right?
Yeah, and I did. I was crazy about all this stuff, and I started in the race team, and the sport was just blossoming in the early...
What year was this?
74.
74, okay.
And the team had been put together maybe a year earlier with the likes of Gary Jones and Marty Tripes, and, you know, the bikes, it was... really kind of rough, you know, in that not the bikes per se, but the whole structure of the race organization within American Honda's sales and marketing. They're not really a technical
and
engineering.
Those 74 Hondas were not up to speed compared to the competition.
They sold a lot of them. They had a dealer network. They were high quality, lightweight, but Suzuki and Yamaha were actively racing Grand Prix circuits in Europe.
And Honda wasn't.
And we weren't. And if you were on smooth tracks at Saddleback, and I won't say Carlsbad, it wasn't that smooth.
No.
Like, let's say more scrambles tracks, it wasn't as apparent. If you got to European-style rough tracks, our shortcomings were
right
pronounced.
There.
Yeah. So... Right. We really struggled with that through the 70s.
But not for long.
Going into the 80s, and I think part of it was in the 70s. You mentioned you had a Honda car from that era. But I think they even took some of their engineering resource to develop. There was an oil embargo, and they developed a clean-burning Civic. And then, but they didn't have as much focus on motorcycle racing like Yamaha with Kenny Roberts and World Grand Prix.
They were interested in the fact that you meet the nicest people.
The nicest people, yeah.
I was just up at the museum. They just opened a Honda museum, brand new. You'll have to go if you haven't been. And one of the and I'm looking at, you know, I always like to buy something from, you meet the nicest people, and then they're on a little Honda. I think it was a 50 step through. Hold that thought. We got to take a quick break. This is Racer Radio, FM 96.1, AM 1170.
The Answer.
Okay, so what is it? Welcome back to Racer Radio, FM 96.1, AM 1170.
The Answer.
Segment brought to you by El Cajon Ford, where absolutely nobody treats you better than El Cajon Ford, 1595 East Main Street in lovely El Cajon. Go to ElCajonMotors.com for any of your new used Fords. Service department's phenomenal. I mean, you really can't beat it. El Cajon Ford, where absolutely nobody treats you better. And they support Barona Speedway.
Yes, which should be active
next weekend.
And I guess all of us racers should keep watching Facebook posts to see if there's going to be a practice. So far, what I've seen is they say, we understand we want to practice. We know you guys want to practice, but I don't know that is official yet.
Well,
so
Mother
Nature
might have something to say about
when
it.
I said this last time, too. The weather did look good. The weather does, again, look really good for this upcoming weekend.
Right. So let's keep our fingers crossed.
But April 13th, IMCA Modified, IMCA Sport Mods, IMCA Sport Compacts, Dwarf Cars, SoCal Lightning Sprints with the Wing, Pure Stocks, Mini Dwarfs, and Junior Sprints. We are all on the schedule with the Greg Smith Memorial as well. And Dave, guess who came home? Guess who came home? The little 37.
Oh, really?
Yes, she's back home. I had to talk to my Mustang and explain to her why she's back outside under the carport and not in my one-car garage. She understands. She didn't like it, but my Mustang is now outside. 24-year-old Mustang, which is in good shape.
Did you fire her up?
The 37? Yes, I did, because I had to. Yes, I did.
Had to get it up the driveway.
I had to get it onto the trailer from Darren's house.
They make
garage.
Car covers.
They do. I have a carport, but my Mustang's a daily driver. I am not putting a car cover on and off every day. But my race car gets my one-car garage, and she's back home. She's been away for a while. But back to Dave Arnold, we could go in a million directions. Dave, did you have any follow-up questions about?
No, go right ahead.
Well, I was just curious, just in listening to you talk and maybe a little bit of research. You were part of the research and development, and it was always kind of cutting edge. You're always pushing it for the next season, right?
I mean, it's production development. It's a complete different timeline than race bike development. Even though you work with whether it's a workspace or a production base, I mean, you got to get, you know, you're developing through the season.
Yeah.
Every Sunday, you're evaluating whether you won or not and why didn't you and what do you got to do and make parts money. But then when you start talking production development, yes, you can do deeper analysis and a little bit more long-term.
And you like that stuff, right?
Oh, I love all that stuff. I like dealing with smart people, engineers, and big development budgets and all that
and
stuff.
And challenges.
Yeah. Making a better mousetrap has always been a tickle my fancy kind of a thing.
How close did you stay to the rules?
Well, you know, there was, I don't know that much about car racing, but wasn't there a real famous smoking unit guy that said you weren't cheating if you didn't get caught?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
And where do you think NASCAR got all of their tech guys?
Weren't there cars that actually got started up in the pit area after tech inspection and then without the gas tank hooked up and drove back to the pits? So.
Funny thing, huh?
Oh, wow. Well,
it's the only sport that you could cheat. Now, not today. Today, they really whack you hard. But back in the day, it's the only sport you could cheat and not get penalized.
Cheating has a very negative connotation.
Yeah, pushing the boundaries.
I would say there's things that are black and white, like displacement.
Right.
I mean, this is
there's a lot of gray.
There's a lot of gray.
Yeah.
In that way, no, never. But we were very creative.
Yeah. Well, creative in finding the gray areas.
Because if the rules said A, B, and you found A minus or B plus, then you found A minus and B plus.
It's just racing, you know, you can push a lot of creative boundaries, and maybe you're limited. Even when I went to production regulation, okay, a production chassis with production geometries, but you can make elliptical parts, you can move, sure. You can change pivot points, you can change angles.
You had a say on that, didn't you? The geometry of the chassis, and did you have an actual influence
on
it?
Yeah, I had quite a bit of influence. I don't want to get all crazy with it, but I had, it was actually, ironically, behind closed doors, high-level Japanese engineers, I was, in motocross, you needed the chassis to go over bumps, okay? I mean, that was and so they would tell me, Dave, don't get crazy on us, it's Honda Motor Company, it's not Honda Chassis Company, you guys figure it out. So myself, Roger DeCoster to some degree, there was a chassis engineer at HRC, Yasuki Tsurumi, and you know, you rely on each other's strengths. He was the analytical, theoretical, and then we're that, you know, but everything had to go through our filter, and we were at test tracks every day we could.
Pushing those riders.
I say again?
Pushing the riders.
Pushing the riders, yeah.
Get back out there.
Yeah. Wearing the riders out.
Yeah.
More likely.
Right. Well, to give you an example, Scott Pruitt.
Yeah.
You've heard of Scott.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, in my 20s, I managed a go-kart track up in Davis, California. And his dad brought him to our track, started him at 8 o'clock in the morning, and wouldn't let him out of the cart till 5 at night. So it's kind of the same thing which you did with your riders, but he was constantly, he was changing pipes, he was changing tire pressure, he was changing everything.
Yeah. At some point, you know, I think as the sport evolved, you know, you start to rely on your guys. When they do become competitive, you need a baseline. You don't want to make a lot of changes. You don't want them testing a lot. It gets confusing.
Right.
And then you start hiring, I don't want to call it Jeff Stanton, a B level. When I hired him, he was like a workhorse guy to support a Ricky Johnson. I didn't care if he was tired going into the weekend. But, you know, by the end of that same year, Ricky Johnson got hurt and Jeff Stanton became the champion. So then things changed. So,
funny thing, huh?
Yeah.
He's smiling through all this.
Well, you get out what you put in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
really
right.
And the people that put in more than the other person usually got out more than the other person.
Hard work pays off.
Yeah. Hard work pays off. And innovation. Innovation.
Yeah, I'm just watching, because the listeners, it's radio and not TV, just the smile. My angle was just about setup being a racer. And so I see some people in the pits, they just go mental. But you just said, you know, you don't want to change too much at a time. And it seemed like you embraced it. I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I'm very guilty of changing too much at racetracks. And there becomes a point in time where diminishing returns, right? You're doing all this change and big crazy stuff and big development. And then, you know, we think we got it all figured out. And I would go to the racetrack and say to Bob Hanna, look, this thing worked well. I'm not telling you what to do, but we throw something on his bike that he'd never even ridden, you know, and he would go to sometimes it worked, and then after the first moto, he's like, Dave, take that crap off, you know, so anyway.
Yeah, putting a wing on the back is not going to work.
No, it's not going to help.
Yeah, it's not going to help. Well, you know, like I said, but you get so into it. Yeah, you get so involved in it that sometimes you have to stop and take a deep breath.
And that was then. That was more the 80s. It's matured into something where if you take any of these major teams, they have people.
And technology.
They have maybe even over the hill or a little bit past their prime racers, and they'll hire him to do all that workhorse stuff, get it close.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the proper time of the season, depending on where they're at in the series, you know, if you're competitive, you don't want to screw it up. Right. If you're not, you're willing to try some things. And but they have people kind of flush it all out behind the scene, and then they'll bring it to the first string guys.
Yeah.
So what are you doing now?
Right now, let's see, my latest thing, I'm helping Triumph, of all things, the English brand. It's not the same Triumph that went out of business in the mid-70s. But it got brought back by a John and Nick Bloor real estate developers, and then they recreated the brand and built a new factory and started building classic bikes and road bikes and around mid-95, and it's been growing ever since. And now they want to get into developing dirt bikes and having a whole line of dirt bikes. And so then I got a call to help them with some of the development surrounding that.
Well, that seems to be the trend. You know, a lot of these vintage names, Royal Enfield, for mm-hmm. example, just yeah. out of the clear blue, now Royal Enfield is competitive.
Yes.
You know, and it would have never been competitive if somebody hadn't have said, well, hey, let's bring it back.
Yeah.
You know, I'm waiting for Bull Taco. I'm waiting for Husqvarna. Well, Husqvarna is already here. But
didn't BSA make a brand new Thumper, a Gold Star?
Exactly.
And Triumph did this. And yeah. yeah.
Go ahead.
Nope. I was just saying, this is brand new, right? Did it just come out in 24?
Yes.
The Triumph?
Yeah. We just got, I don't know if I can say bikes are at dealerships. I know they're signing up dealers. I know they brought 300 bikes into the country. They had a big press ride in Florida a couple of weeks ago that mm-hmm. went extremely well. So
that's
for
right.
for how little time, I mean, I've worked with quite a bit with the Japanese. I've worked with the Austrians, and it's the production stuff has come out extremely well for how little test time compared
yeah.
to some of these established processes and bureaucracies, and
is
how big the changes
own,
and they're starting from zero.
Is this their own design? Or are they borrowing from anybody?
No, they're not borrowing anybody's design. I mean, they do buy components from, let's say, KYB yeah. or yeah. Brembo
well,
brakes.
Yeah,
and
yeah, yeah.
Like
but
that.
I mean, they're not reinventing the wheel.
Engine and chassis are completely their design.
Wow.
I won't say there are similarities. They look at
well,
they look
well there's
the
only
board.
So much you
they
can
do.
Do right?
They do market research, and if somebody says, I like my Honda and I like my KTM, believe me, they're looking at the
yeah.
Honda's
KTM. Looking at the KTM. Yeah, so they're not going to turn around and say, well, those are nice, but we have to make it different.
Yeah.
Oh, you do want to spend more money. Oh, I see how that is.
So they're not in the consumer's hand just yet? Is that
I
what
don't
I'm hearing?
They are, no.
Remember Smokin' Joe? Mm-hmm. He brought in mm-hmm. Tommy Croft, and yeah, he told me he was getting one. I just assumed he had it already. I didn't realize they weren't out yet.
Yeah, they're probably not.
I would say any day if they are not already, but they had a big...
Well, if they had the press, usually yeah. they'll have a press event,
yeah.
and then a couple of months afterwards,
yeah, yeah.
it'll hit the streets.
Yeah.
Can I take you back? Can we go reverse?
You got a
backwards?
Minute.
Backwards? Oh, no.
What
oh,
time is it?
No, because a little birdie wanted me to ask
it sounds like David Bailey.
Wow, you're good.
That's because he's a little bird.
He suggested I ask you how he got hired onto the team.
How he got hired? Well, Roger DeCoster and I, were Japan got heavily involved. There was a LPL's large project leader right under Soshiro Honda, the founder, and they formed this HRC. It's going to be full works development for motocross road racing, and they even had trials bikes at the time. But in any case, we were supposed to run out and hire the number one motocrosser in the States, but the team and the bikes really weren't that developed.
Attracted, yeah.
So anyway, we went after Mark Barnett. He was the number one supercross guy, and it ended up that we had a verbal, whatever you call that, a rough agreement, but mm-hmm. we didn't finalize the contract, so Suzuki kept him. In any case, we didn't have any first-string A-level guys, so... The joke was within the team, we went to the local tracks with a bus and just started loading people, you know, picking up Donnie Hansen, Johnny O'Mara. Mm-hmm. These guys had not won national much of anything. Danny Laporte had, I think he was a former 500 national champion. He was on the team almost ready to go off and race in Europe. But in any case, back to Bailey, I saw Bailey race. I mean, I knew that his father raced Bull Tacos, and David was on a Kawasaki support program called Team Green, but it was one ride at Unadilla where I thought for a non-factory level guy, he rode extremely well, and that was enough for me to con Roger into it, and we hired the guy.
Con Roger into it.
I love it.
Good decision.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Earl Cox Jr. first.
Figure eight.
And then we'll finish up with Hot Rod here on Racer Radio, FM 96.1 AM 1170.
The Answer.
back to Racer Radio FM 96.1 AM 1170.
The Answer.
The segment's brought to you by Black Forest Automotive, 8066 Engineer Road in San Diego. If you got a BMW, Mini, or Porsche, and you're looking for a dealer alternative, you need to check out Black Forest Automotive. They're at 8066 Engineer Road in lovely San Diego. Go to blackforestautomotive.com, 858-292-1192. And if you got any one of those three cars and you decide you want to go racing, they can hook you up because they've got the best of the best within Black Forest. All right, we've got, this is also Paris Auto Speedway segment, where it's an amazing half-mile track up in Paris, California, 18700 Lake Paris Road. You need to check their website, parisautospeedway.com, for future races. Right now, we got Earl Cox Jr. on the line. Hey, Earl, how you doing, buddy?
Good, good. Just cleaned up from last night's race. Watching the NASCAR race and cleaned up the shop and go from there.
Cool. Did you have a good run last night?
Yeah, we did good. Like lap nine, we got the 10 car got in the back of us, and the last nine laps we kind of finished on a flat on the right rear, but we still finished in one.
Oh, you still finished in one? Okay, well that's not too bad. And you come from a long line of racers, like Dad.
Yeah, my dad started in the 60s and ran oval, and then in the 70s started racing figure eight, and my mom raced ovals and ran a couple figure eights herself, and then she was going to Japan teaching women how to do stunts back in Japan, and I followed.
No kidding. Wow, how unique. So it's probably hard for them to tell you not to drive crazy, huh?
Yeah, my dad still tells me, you know, he's in his mid-80s, and he's telling me that he still kicked my butt.
That is so good. So you've kind of stuck with the same thing that's been in the family for years, figure eight and that type of racing?
Yeah, I can't get away from it. It's been, you know, that I've watched it all my life, and, you know, I've seen it on TV, you know, like Chips back in the days, you know, they ran, you know, a couple episodes with figure eight racing, my mom and dad doing that with Chips, and just, you know, it's something that's been in my mind all my life.
Mm. Well, that's great. How long have you been racing?
Since 84.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. So you've
deep history.
Yeah. So yep. Mainly at Paris?
I started at Ascot in 84, and then we went to Paris, I think, 89, I think it was, 90.
Right.
Not to make you blush, but word on the street is you're one of the nice guys out there. One of the nicest guys out there.
Yeah.
And is it true that if you win, somebody else takes your car back to the pits so that you can go out to the grandstands?
Yes. Either my son-in-law or my brother, they'll take the car back, and I go up in the grandstands. And, you know, I like to meet everybody in the stands and see who, you know, who we are. You know, they try to put the face on the car.
Right.
Because I built a car, you know, this new car I had, well, it's not new, but 4 years ago, we had built this new Deadpool car, and my son-in-law was like, we need to build a Deadpool car because there's the Batman, there was, you know, there was a couple of the cars, and I'm like, who is Deadpool? He's like, you never seen Deadpool?
Yeah, watch this.
I've never seen Deadpool. So
I think
built the Deadpool car.
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, it's so true, though, when the spectators know something about the driver, it gives them a reason to come out and root for you.
Yes, correct. And so I wanted to put the face to the car, mm-hmm. and go in the stands and, you know, do autographs, stickers, and shirts. And so they have an idea, and they look forward to coming back and seeing you. And then that's what's been going on, and I love it.
Do you know what he's talking about when it says Deadpool?
Mm-hmm.
You've
the
seen,
movie.
I love that movie.
Oh, you do? Yeah. Funny.
That's one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, my parents introduced. I wouldn't have known if my parents hadn't sat me down and said, watch this.
You don't sit down.
I don't
would
sit
you
down.
Watch 5 minutes
yeah,
and then
yeah,
you left?
I watch. It's entertaining. It's a funny one.
So now did you paint your car like Deadpool, or is your driving suit look like it?
No, it's the car. It's, you know, it's Deadpool. It's a red car with the Deadpool stickers on it with the case and stuff. And the, you know, the I like the kids that come out of stands and, you know, you get a little banged up on the car and the kids like, Deadpool never dies.
Ah. Like,
that's true. That is so true. Yeah, that's. Yep. I just watched it the other night. I love that movie. Yeah. So and I now just going up into the stands, was this something you did, or did your dad do it as well?
No, it's something I've been doing, and I just hopefully some of the other drivers follow, because it's, you know, last year and the year before, Paris didn't do the first, second, and third trophies, and so they just doing the first. So I was just going up there because I was the face, or whoever, or who won the race would need to go up in the stands and react with the fans, and that's what I chose to do, because it was something different, and I wanted to do it.
Brittany just showed me a picture of your car. It's really cool. That's really cool.
You need one? I can build you one.
Yeah, you can build Brittany. She races. She does.
Oh, yeah, I'll build you one.
Yeah, she drives a dwarf car.
Come on over to figure eights. Come on to the real side.
Ooh.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it the real side, but it does look real fun.
And she is she wants to do the double decker.
No, if you got a height problem, you're scared of heights, don't do it.
I don't even know how they get up in the top
one. I like the Enduro Cross, or whatever the one is, you know, where they go straight along the straightaway, and then they make a sharp turn, and they go back and forth, and there's no...
I think that is Enduro Cross. Do you do that as well?
Nope. I strictly do figure eight. I like my figure eight, because it's those guys that demo cross, I like, they do a lot of wrecking and crashing, and that's not for me.
Yeah. Nobody likes to crash. I mean, let's face it.
Have you ever closed your eyes when you're doing the crisscross part?
No.
I do not close my eyes.
How about one eye?
No.
All right.
Yeah.
I don't close eyes, no.
It costs too much to build those cars to be, you know, doing that.
The thing is, it's not cost. It's every race. To build it is you know, it's something that you're going to race every race, but to bring it to the next race, that's when it starts costing things, because you want to improve it and you want to be better than the other guy, so it keeps costing you more and more, but you always want to be the best, so it's always going to cost you more money.
Right. So who sponsors the car?
Of course, my wife and BFA, Troy Mickelson and Mirror Images. They're both really good for the Deadpool car. You know, they've been on my car for a while, and Troy Mickelson builds the motors, and we've been flawless with the motors, and it's been really good the last 4 or 5 seasons with this motor.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a really good, it's not the biggest motor out there, it's a good combination for the car and the track.
Well, that's the important thing, because, you know, it's not always about horsepower, it's, you know, truly about the combination of the two. We've got an engineer in the house who comes from the motorcycle world, so he can totally understand what we're talking about, right?
Yeah, get your gearing, the tire, and the motor combination going, and if you can drive a little bit, you can get it figured out.
Yeah,
yeah. I was talking to Roger DeCoster a couple of days ago, and I'm starting to work with Triumph, and it's new for them to get back into motocross and develop a bike. But I don't really think our bike has the most horsepower, but it's getting almost all the starts. So we were talking about the right combination of power and gearing and everything else.
So it crosses all paths of motorsports, really. And I think Earl, you're right on the money. I mean, it's all about the combination of finding that combination and then making it work.
Yeah, my motor sponsor, he builds more than just mine out there. He builds a few of the other guys, and some of the other guys, or they have a little bit more cubic inch than I got in there. They can't believe that what my size motor of my car is compared to theirs. And he's like, I'll give you the specs. His is actually the smallest motor out there.
Well, that might have something to do with the setup and the driver, because that's all that's left.
Or luck.
Well, there all is. Right. Especially in figure eight. I think luck is probably a huge component, no doubt about it.
If that button starts, And it fires up, that's the first luck.
Yeah, that's right.
The getting on the track is the next one, but you know, it's a lot of it's luck, and then you just got to know how to put your car in the right place. If you don't put your car in the right place, it's, you know, it'd be a bad night for you.
Yeah. Totally got it. All right, buddy. Well, I'll tell you what, it's when's your next race?
It's going to be May 4th is our next race at Paris Auto Speedway.
All right. Yeah, we try to get people to make sure they get on the website and check it out and make sure that they are definitely up there because you guys put on a real good show with Night of Destruction. So keep up the good work, and we'll talk to you down the road.
I appreciate it. I want to give good thanks to Don Kazarian and and the guys out there getting the track ready for us, because the last, you know, Mother Nature's been pounding us, and they've been having it ready for us, and I want to let them know that I appreciate their hard work, because it hasn't been easy for those guys, and Scott DeLoso on top of it.
Yeah, you got
I want to thank everybody. Thank you, guys.
All right, thank you, man, and have fun.
All right, hope to see you guys out there.
We're working on it.
All right.
All right, take care, buddy. Take care. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we come back a whole lot more right here on Racer Radio, FM 96.1 AM 1170.
The Answer.
Racer Radio, FM 96.1 AM 1170.
The Answer.
Are you in trouble again?
Well, you know, I get myself in trouble for being honest.
Well, I was downstairs and I had to run inside, and I noticed everyone had their headphones. I was like, oh my God. And I started running to make sure we go to commercial.
Well, I think we did come a little early.
Yeah.
No, it's okay.
It's okay.
When I came in, all I heard was like, oh. And I was like, oh, that's not supposed to be on the air, whatever.
That was Brittany. That wasn't me. I'm polite.
I'm not. I keep it real. I teach middle school, and there's just this balance between soft and hard. Like, just like keeping it real and keeping it supportive.
No offense when I say this. Dave Stahl was in the military, so he's got that military mouth when it comes to off the air.
No, it's me. No, I'm the guilty party.
Way. Dave Stahl cusses way more than you
he's
do.
He's pointing at me with his little stubby finger.
Well, in all fairness, and I don't know why I'm throwing myself under the bus even more, but the ratio with you working with him for 6 hours and just 1 hour for me, ratio of you getting yourself in trouble, Dave, unfortunately, is much higher.
I understand now. I understand.
And I do a good job. I try.
Yes, you do. Yes.
Hey, we have a guest. He's just kind of wandering around. You're going to go take care of him? No?
Well, in the meantime.
Oh, you're talking about the one behind me. Sorry. I thought you were talking to the
Certified Car Clinic sponsors this segment. Tell you what, they got a dyno in-house, so anything that they do, they can prove what they did. 11370 North Woodside Avenue in Santee. Certified Car Clinic. Check them out. And Weather Machine. Man, I tell you, we had them just come out today. We had a little thing bleep up on our thermostat. Wasn't taking a chance. 9303 Bond Avenue, Unit B in El Cajon. Call them. 619-443-9974. 619-443-9974. Go to weathermachine.net. Weathermachine.net.
So are we going to let Dave kind of finish his David Bailey?
No, just real quick.
And he wants to be nice.
It's just to be nice, yeah. I mean, you asked me about how did David Bailey get hired, but the team that we had in the early 80s, it was Johnny O'Mara, David Bailey. They remained both good friends. And then Donnie Hansen and Ricky Johnson. But David Bailey became one of, if not the best, 500cc open class two-stroke racers in the world. And we went to Europe. I mean, he won nationally. He won all the international races in Europe. And there was a lot of racers that were really good on 125 and 250s that weren't good on 500 two-strokes at all. Ricky Johnson, being a better 250 guy, ended up being one of the best supercross guys in the sport, but especially 86, 87. Johnny O'Mara, 125 national champion and 250 supercross national champion. But I wanted to give David a little bit of respect because
we didn't just hire him out of desperation.
We didn't just hire him. So he did something with it.
Hey, look, there's a motorcycle guy. Let's hire him.
You just said two-stroke. A listener texted in and wanted your thoughts on two-strokes.
I mean,
because they get a bad rap.
They get a bad. Well, I don't know. It becomes I work for Honda.
Yeah.
And I can just tell you, like, some of these regulatory bodies, you know, they'll hold the biggest players accountable for policing the industry. And so in the case of Honda, they would make these four strokes for off-road and two strokes for closed course competition. And then, yeah, the the whoever the feds or the local agencies, they can't police everybody riding those bikes in the desert. So I don't really know how to answer it other than over time, you're selling a whole bunch of two strokes, and we don't want you selling that many two strokes because, I don't know, it just is what it is. I mean, things were simpler, and they worked really well, and the sport was cheaper. I mean, I remember when we started developing four-stroke motocross bikes, and there's a lot to like about four-stroke motocross bikes, but I remember the Japanese engineers saying the cost of racing is going to go way up, and that's a fact.
So Dave, I don't know if you recall, Norm Bigelow was sitting right here 2 weeks ago, and I brought him up to our guest because I told him how Norm was hiding all the bikes that were supposed to be destroyed, and he has kind of a similar
story. Do you have any motorcycles you're not supposed to have?
No, unfortunately, if I had it to do over again, I would answer that differently. But I was pretty ethical about the whole thing, except and when I got hired on as a mechanic in early 74, I was a local racer in Southern California, and I had bikes in my van that were readily available. But when you start working for the factory, you see all the exotic stuff and the magnesium and titanium and handmade parts and lightweight parts. And then there's a pile of them, and they say, all right, destroy all that stuff. And you're like, makes you want to cry, right? Yeah. Beating up magnesium.
And you did it anyway.
Yeah. And so then flash forward not quite 10 years, let's say 7-8 years later, I become the manager, and I was helping him I was helping Honda lay out a new facility, and part of the race shop I had, you know, you got workshops and you got parts department, fab, machine shops, offices for the staff, and then we had conference rooms. Well, I set it up for two conference rooms. We only really needed one. I was the only key for the other one, and I started stashing. Now, all these bikes came in the country on temporary import bills, and there's tax implications and there's liability implications, but they're still cool and they're exotic and they're one-off handmade. So I would start fudging paperwork, and I started filing them under this lock and key on a nobody else had access. And we got over 30 of them before it was, I mean, Works Bike regulation ended in 85, and it was production in 86. So then it went, after I'd quit the management role, you know, I had people still in the company saying, you know, you shouldn't have done that. That was the wrong thing. And then, so I was in trouble. You can't fire me. I was already gone. But then they become the corporate heirlooms, you know. Now they treasure them. Now they're in museums. Now if you want to borrow one, you got to get $1 million bond. So right. It's gone through the full cycle.
Yeah, it has.
Yeah, I know. I know. I have a love affair. You know, I'm going to have to bring this up. The Honda 305 Scrambler.
Great bike. CL77.
Dude, I did things with that bike that you guys would have thought, what the hell are you doing? But I can't get another one because every time I get close to buying one, it jumps another $2,000. They're over $8,000 to $10,000.
I haven't tracked the value. And honestly, when I worked there, I go, nobody will ever collect stuff like this. But it's hugely collectible now. And
I used to commute 100 miles a day on a CL77 in Northern California in the winter.
Those bikes were distinct. I think it was the first bikes to do the Baja 1000. Yep. Dave and Bud Eakins.
Bud Eakins. Yeah. I know. And I loved that bike. I mean, and it would, I just immediately said, this bike will do anything I want it to do.
Dave Eakins, Bud Eakins' brother, was in Japan for some dealer event unrelated to, and they were testing that bike, and they knew that he rode. He was kind of an American Southern California hero, or his brother for sure was as well. And he was like in a shirt and tie and pants, and then they said, threw on a helmet, and he got to try it. So it was a great story.
Oh, my God. But like I said, and I won't go to Mecum because, if you go to Mecum to their motorcycle auction, have you ever gone there?
I've never gone. I've followed some of the stuff that's gone through there.
Anytime you get near those auctions, man, you're gonna really. But I found every once in a while I'll find a CL. Every once in a while,
just like cars. The irony of that whole thing is, if you got one and the amount of money it takes to restore it, you better just find one that's already been.
Well, no, that's exactly what I'm gonna do, because I found a couple basket cases. No, I've been down that silly road. But just think, you know, it's like the old saying goes: just think, if you'd have known today what you didn't know yesterday.
Very true.
You could be a multimillionaire if just sitting on Hondas. Really, when you come right, one of these days you'll have to go up to their latest museum. They've got their Yeah, because one thing Honda was very innovative. I mean, there's a CBR, that straight six motorcycle.
Yep.
The Honda 750. I had a 550.
That CB750 is the, I won't say, it's almost single-handedly responsible for putting the British industry out of business.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the 750 didn't help either.
No.
I mean, the 750, when that bike came out, the industry said, what the heck is this?
Yeah.
And I really like, for whatever reason, the 554.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just, yeah.
They had a 354, they had a 400, they had a 550, they had a 750.
So you can tell I'm a Honda guy.
Yeah.
I mean, I rode Harleys for a while, and I was never into Goldwings because they were just too fancy.
Do you know that the first Goldwing was brought over to be a super bike? It didn't come with all the saddlebags and fairings and everything. It was supposed to be...
stripped down.
Wow.
It was stripped down, and it was supposed to be like the next... not a sport, but it was like a sport touring type bike, and it didn't really go over that well. And then it was Greg Vetter started building touring.
So they bagged the snot out of it.
And then everybody, and then all of a sudden, we better make that. And then it turned into this big touring line.
So what do you think of this bagger division that they're racing in AMA?
I don't know that much about it, but
you've seen it.
Yeah, I've seen it.
What are you doing out there with a bagger?
Well, what are people doing on Harleys on speedway tracks?
Oh.
Yeah, well, there's something to be said for that.
It's entertainment.
I follow all forms of motorcycles. Her dad's even worse. Yeah. I got him up. I get books, like I was telling you, and it was a book on Valentino Rossi.
Yeah.
And her dad is a Valentino Rossi fanatic.
Uber fan.
So I gave him the book. You know, I said, here, you just take it and read it. Goes in his bedroom, gets his Valentino Rossi helmet out. Pops it on his head and read the book.
Yeah.
There's a hardcore. I did, where was I? I was doing a job. I was, went to a bicycle retail thing in Las Vegas, and there was a distributor of Eddie Merckx bicycles there, and there was an Italian lady there, and there wasn't really much to talk about. It was a big table of, you know, Roger DeCoster was there and Eddie Merckx was there. And then this Italian lady, she didn't have anything until she heard I worked for Honda, and Honda was in the process of parting ways with Valentino Rossi.
Oh.
And she started reading me the riot act up and down.
It's all your fault.
It was all my fault.
Well, buddy, this has been a blast. I'm sorry you had to drive so far, but not really. You're more than welcome. I'm sure stay in touch with her and she'll hook up because we love talking to the history. You know, we love talking to the people that made what's happening today happen. And it sounds like you enjoy talking about it too.
Yeah, it's all fun. I enjoy the history of motocross and
history of
both the personalities involved, but also the technical advancements. So.
Yeah. Oh, personalities.
Well, if you get a chance, go to Don MD and look up some of his books. I got them. I haven't opened them.
You better get in your comfortable reading chair, right?
Oh, you better get into it.
Well, thank you, Dave and Brittany. It's been a blast.
It's totally our pleasure. Brittany will send you a copy of the show, so you'll have it and share it with the friends and family. Brittany, it's always a blessed. You're awesome.
Sounds
here on
good,
Racer
Dave.
Radio, FM 96.1 AM 1170.
The Answer.